Well, the lesson I planned to teach last week, we kind of got diverted on a very, non-controversial subject of the role of women in ministry and spiritual gifts. So, we're studying Proverbs 8, the creation text, verses 23 through 36 in Proverbs 8. And what I wanted to discuss last week was a series of scientific discoveries, literally just published in the last 14 days, that actually focus on the text that we're looking at. And it begins with a special issue of the journal Science, where they devoted the issue, very interestingly, to parenting. I mean, but what they came up with was stunning confirmation of what the Bible's been teaching for thousands of years. Namely, that parenting is a good thing. So, but probably the most controversial study of all, controversial in the sense that it was really difficult for them to get permission to actually do the experiment. And it was done in Eastern Europe, where they found an orphanage. And so what they were doing was an experiment where they looked at children who have been raised from the time that they were born in an orphanage, basically what they called an institutionalized system. This is why they had trouble getting permission, because people who were running the orphanage didn't like the title, were institutionalizing children. But what they were contrasting was children raised in an orphanage compared with children who were taken from the orphanage and given foster care. And what they discovered is that when they measured the IQ of these children at age 8, there was a substantial difference between the children that were raised in foster care homes and those who were raised in the orphanage. And the point being that it really does affect the brain development when they lack any kind of parenting. Now, they said they would have loved to have done a study where they contrast foster parents with, quote, biological parents. That hasn't been done, but it'd be interesting to see the difference they would get there. But they did note that the foster care children, those that had, quote, good foster care, and we all know that there's a difference between good and not so good foster care. And what they meant by foster care is where the foster parents actually were loving and nurturing and where they weren't being shifted from one foster care parent to another one. So it was a stable situation where they had the same foster parents for the first 8 years of their life. And what they did discover in that particular case, that there was no difference in the IQ test scores for children raised by their actual parents and those that were given, quote, high quality foster care. It was the same. So but huge difference when they were comparing institutionalized orphans with those that were getting high-quality foster care. Now, in the same issue of Science, they also...
Did they give numbers for what the IQ differences were?
They were careful about that because the IQ test you get at age 8 really isn't a definitive measure of IQ.
I just think there's a difference.
Yeah, they were getting like a 20 to 30 point difference, so it was substantial. But they were cautious by saying, don't read too much into the numbers. And, that often happens, is that the IQ of people will change dramatically. I mean, I don't know what it's like here in the United States. When I was raised in Canada, every Canadian got an IQ test at age 8. Then they gave you another one at age 15. And it was interesting how the IQ would change for some people and not change for others. Yes?
This gentleman has to say something here.
Okay.
Well, he made me do it.
All right. Well, he's good at that.
I just wanted to drive. He heard me say I had 3 foster parents, and they were high quality, thank goodness.
They were.
And here I am.
Here you are, and you're obviously an intelligent person, so it's worked out well. Yes?
Did they take them all at about the same age?
Yes.
When they were taken from the orphanage?
Okay. These children were taken from the orphanage and given high-quality foster care before they hit 24 months of age. And for most of them, they were taken while they were just a few months old. So, but yeah, they cut it off at 24 months. So, but even then, they were able to get this quite substantial measure. But yeah, I mean, the people who wrote the paper making the point is, you know, it was very difficult for them to do this study because of all the politicalization of, you know, orphanage care. But they said it'd be really good to follow this up with, you know, some of the experiments we've been talking here. What would it be like with biological parents as opposed to, you know, and then in your particular case, you had three foster parents. Is there a difference between having one and multiple? And, you know, what I've heard, you know, there's a gal in our office that's a foster parent, and she says the variation, the quality of foster care here in California can be night and day. For some of it, it's just an utter terror, and others, it's very high quality. So that's one thing the study said. So we made, you know, when we said high quality, our only thing was that, you know, they had just one set of foster parents, and the foster parents did provide them with nurturing care during that time. But they really didn't define it. And said it'd be good to actually try to break it down and see, because it said this whole point is it'd be a useful study on who we recruit for foster parents. So anyway, this was followed up by another paper also published in the same issue where they looked at mammalian parenting. So, I mean, we're talking anything from mice and shrews to rats. And that was all focused on birds and mammals only. They didn't look at frogs. I mean, just they only looked at those creatures that actually have parental care. I mean, that's kind of a common factor for all birds and mammals. All bird and mammal species provide care for their offspring, some a little more so than others. But what they pointed out is that, you know, there are certain things that can happen in a particular species, for example, where the mother abandons her offspring. And so they looked at abandoned offspring as opposed to those that were nurtured and cared for until they were able to function as an adult. And when they compared those two, they discovered that the brain development was hampered where they were not getting that parental care. And in particular, there's a portion of the brain of all birds and mammals that supports social interactions. And it was that part of the brain that didn't properly develop. So, but they said the same thing's true of human beings. If a human being isn't getting any kind of parental care, then it impacts the development of that portion of the brain. Yes?
Have they ever contemplated doing a study comparing IQ of children raised by two heterosexual parents?
Well, the original paper, the paper is called An Experiment in Zero Parenting. But they were suggesting, as they were closing the paper, yes, it'd be good to subdivide this study and look at questions like you're addressing. But they said the problem is they're even more politically charged than the study they did. And so, I mean, they said, you know, it's an issue just getting funding for these studies and then trying to get permission from institutions to do these studies. They actually were very blunt about how much resistance they encountered from the orphanage even to conduct the study. And so they said, yes, this would be great research to do, but there's a lot of resistance to it. And, you know, it's not surprising. There are people who don't hold a Christian worldview, and they're not too excited about confirming, you know, the tenets that we see in Scripture. The interesting thing about the paper about mammals and birds is they discovered it didn't matter what species of bird or mammal you looked at. The impairment of the development of that part of the brain was the same. And the question they kind of left unanswered is, why is it the same? Well, again, if you look at the book of Job, the whole point is God designed these birds and mammals to serve and please human beings and to relate to human beings. And in that context, it's important that they all have the basic same social interaction equipment operating in their brain. So they asked a question at the end that they left unanswered, but from a biblical perspective, I think we do have an answer as to why it would be the same. Yes?
There was a study, and I don't remember when it was, but it took, involved children younger, just infants, still in in the crib, in orphanages, that, not necessarily in America, but when they did not have, when they were not cared for by picking them up or holding them, they just put the bottle in the bed with them and fed them, and there was no physical contact hardly at all with the babies. So eventually, these children died. They, because there was no stimulation, because there was no interaction at all. The ones that did not have that, they didn't even grow. And so it stands to reason what you said in that study, that if there's no stimulation and no relationship, they're not going to get intelligent, much less live.
Well, there was a study done about a decade ago where they looked at orphanages where the young babies were not given the opportunity to physically engage in physical exercise. And they noted that that resulted in significant physical impairment. The children were walking much later in life and, you know, not able to do physical things that the other children could do. So in that sense, it's important that they be nurtured, not just mentally, but also physically. Yes.
Yeah, that same follow-up study from that one, they did the same thing with monkeys. That one was raised, by their parents in a controlled environment, and the other one, they even subdivided it where it was just a stuffed doll that gave the milk to the baby versus a wire frame that gave the milk to the baby. And so you had three levels, obviously, and even just the stuffed animal giving milk did better than obviously the poor baby that was given just a wire frame mother with the milk. And obviously, what we know obviously from that now is that the brain is like a muscle. When you stimulate it, the neuron connections are made. When the neuron connections aren't made when you're young, they'll be very difficult for them to get connected when you get older.
Right.
So the neuron connections are not made.
And now they're finding the same thing's true for people that are older, is that if you maintain the mental exercise, it can put off the onset of dementia problems. So,
have they done studies for people, those who are, I have to use the term, mentally pinched, developmentally pinched?
Well, there are studies that have been done that show that people of low IQ, once they get appropriate stimulation, can significantly increase their IQ. Now, it doesn't work all the time, but I've read studies where they get an IQ difference of as much as 50 points. So, yeah. Yes.
And then you have the issue of kids who aren't nourished physically, from poverty and so on, where the brain cells really don't develop when they're young. I don't know if that can be corrected when they're older, if these kids have swollen bellies and yellow hair, and that the brain don't physically develop, and that's lifelong.
Well, that's the third paper that was published in the same issue of Science, looking at nourishment when the woman is pregnant. And they said it not only affects the physical aspects of the child that is born, if it's a male child, it actually changes the DNA of that male child's sperm, which means it affects not just one generation, but it can affect multiple generations. Which again is akin to what you see in the scripture, the sins of the parents are passed on to the third and fourth generation. The idea that it can actually affect the DNA of the sperm is something they've never discovered before. And when they talk about malnourishment, they're not just talking starvation. Starvation will change the DNA of the sperm, but also if you've got a bad diet. So say a diet that's high in sugar and low in the proteins and low in minerals and vitamins, even though the mother is, quote, getting enough calories, it can actually damage the DNA of the sperm of her son. Now, interestingly, they noticed that they didn't get the same damage impact on female children. It was the male children that were impacted. So
I heard years ago at Park Street Church, a missionary who'd been in Africa, he was describing the depth of the poverty. He was a doctor, and he talked about the tapeworms that the kids have at all, and he did some research on the tapeworms. And the tapeworms get whatever nourishment comes through the system, they get it first. And then,
right.
And then, but he was studying the tapeworms. They have the same symptoms of malnourishment that the kids had, the swollenness and the yellow hairs.
Right.
That, he said that's how hungry the kids were. Their tapeworms were malnourished.
Their tapeworms were malnourished. So. Yes.
That's epigenetics.
Yeah, this is epigenetics in the sense that, the way people behave can actually impact the DNA that's passed on to the next generation. So this is a new study showing that. And of course, this has an impact on people who claim that the ancestral population of humanity is not two people, but many people. All that is based on the assumption that there's nothing in human behavior that affects the DNA. And this is one more study that shows that that's not the case. It really can affect the DNA. And so behavior is a big factor. So, and hey, the big discovery announced literally yesterday is that they have found life in these Antarctic deep lakes. So, three deep lakes in Antarctica where they've actually found life. Now, when we're talking about deep lakes, we're talking, you know, 3 kilometers of ice. And what's happening in Antarctica is you've got literally kilometers thickness of ice, but when you've got that much ice, the pressure of the ice above will melt the ice at the bottom, which is why where you got really thick ice in Antarctica, you've got liquid water under that ice. It's all generated by the pressure of the ice above. And for a long time, scientists have been wanting to say, well, okay, these lakes are cut off from the atmosphere by kilometers worth of ice. Are there actually microbes there? And so what was just announced in the British journal Nature is that they've now found microbes in all 3 of these deep lakes underneath the Antarctic ice. Now, in a couple of respects, this is not surprising. It's not surprising from a biblical perspective, and it's not surprising from a scientific perspective. Why? Because they have found microbes in mines as much as 2 miles below the surface. And these microbes that they find in these deep mines, especially in South Africa where they got these very deep gold mines, these are bacteria that are feeding on the minerals. And so they're energy-rich minerals that exist in the crust of the earth, and these are microbes that are feeding on those minerals. And wasn't it all surprising that the microbes they found in these lakes underneath the thick Antarctic ice were also feeding on minerals. In fact, they're feeding on the same kinds of minerals. So that's why they were able to survive and under those conditions. And you say, what about a biblical perspective on this? Well, if you read Psalm 104, a creation psalm we were studying last year, it makes the point that no matter where you go on the earth, you're going to find a profusion of life that God has created. So you go to the highest mountains, you'll find life. Go to the deepest oceans, you're going to find life. Wherever you go on the earth, you'll find life. Psalm 104, verse 24, how many are your works, O Lord? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. If you read the rest of Psalm 104, it makes the point, all of the earth is full of the creatures. In fact, all of the earth is packed with the greatest diversity that the laws of physics will permit in that term. And Isaiah 45:18, referring to God, he did not create it, referring to the earth to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. So no matter where we go on the face of the earth, we find wherever is life conceivably possible, it exists there. It exists there in the greatest possible abundance and the greatest possible diversity. And these papers published in Nature are a documentation of that. You were first.
I remember they're starting these drilling. There was concern about contamination that the microbes would find was something that we brought down with them. But it sounds like, as you're saying, from what they're feeding on, that would not be the same kind of life that
they could. Yeah, they addressed that in the paper because they said, yes, they didn't even start the drill to look for these microbes until they were certain that they could guarantee that there wasn't significant contamination. But the very fact that these microbes are so different from the ones that are on the surface tells us that they really are indigenous to those lakes.
Well, the other thing is that that's basically at freezing temperatures down there, right?
Yes.
How are they able to proliferate, or rather than just be?
Well, they are extremophiles, which means they're extreme kinds of life, and they're able to live under these very cold conditions, and they're also extreme in the sense that they're feeding on abnormal food. Now, the consequence of that is their metabolic rates are very low. And so the idea that you could have an extremophile, say, in the early history of the Earth, and have it evolve into what we call mesophiles, life forms that live under, you know, benign conditions. Given their very low metabolic rates and the fact that so much of their DNA is focused on repairing the damage that comes from the extreme environment they're in, the possibility they could evolve into mesophiles is essentially zero. They're not going to be able to do it. I mean, they're struggling just to survive, let alone to have the energy wherewithal to be able to undergo significant bacterial evolution. Yes?
What was the year? Was it, did it match up to like the 3.4 billion of the, that we found, you know, life at the beginning of this planet? Or what year was it that these things happened?
Okay. So how long these microbes have been around in those waters, we don't know. So they've not found any fossils of these microbes. They're simply finding living microbes. So that question can't be addressed. What I can tell you for in general is that they have found fossil parts of a life that dates back 3.47 billion years. They found that in a desert in Australia. So those are the oldest fossils that we have on the face of the Earth. But we have an isotope signature for life. In fact, I'm writing about this in my latest book, where they've now pushed the date as far back as 3.825 billion years. That's one study. Another study said 3.83 billion years is where they got isotope evidence that life existed on the Earth, and not only existed as one species, but as multiple species, because they actually got different isotope ratios all dating at that same time. And to me, what's exciting is that that life that showed up 3.83 billion years ago actually plays a role in getting plate tectonics up and running. Because what that early life did, it was to produce carbon-rich shale, and this carbon-rich shale delivered uranium, because, you know, the life actually participates in precipitating out uranium, and the delivery of those black shales into subduction zones was a big factor in jump-starting the tectonics that eventually gave us continents so we could have actually life on land masses. That's a new piece of research done in the last 6 months that shows that if you don't have long-lasting abundant life on planet Earth, you can't sustain long-lasting plate tectonics. But if you don't have long-lasting plate tectonics, you can't sustain life for a long time on the face of the Earth. So it's actually a synergistic relationship between life and plate tectonics, which is why astrobiologists are now recognizing Earth indeed may be the only place in the entire universe where life persists for more than a few months. Okay, there's a question on this side of the room, or did I answer it? Okay, no, one right here. Yes.
The mineral composition that they're feeding on, could it be argued that that, in turn, is extremely fine-tuned? And two, what was the temperature?
What was the temperature? Well, the temperature of these lakes is right at freezing. So, I mean, it would be below freezing if it wasn't for all the pressure of the ice above. So it's right at freezing. So, but because it's at that low of a temperature, that means we've got a very low metabolic rate for those creatures. But the one thing they did point out in the paper, because of this pressure, the temperature doesn't change. So the water is basically at freezing and stays at freezing. So it's not jumping up and down in temperature, which actually makes it possible for these life forms to persist. If the temperature is jumping up and down, you know, given their what they're feeding on and, you know, their metabolic pathways, they wouldn't make it. But the fact that the temperature remains very steady at freezing point allows them to survive. The minerals are feeding on basically carbon-rich minerals. And, you know, Antarctica has got a lot of coal. So there's carbon down deep in the crust of Antarctica. So, but that's all they said in the papers. They're feeding on carbon-rich molecules.
You,
yes?
Does the pressure, you know, I'm assuming that, you know, the depth, you're saying more than 3 kilometers or so?
Yeah, 3 to 4 kilometers.
Plus, I don't know if the ice weight also comes to bear on that, but what is that, you know, how does that, you know...
What's the freezing number?
Well, not the freezing, but the pressure on these organisms as well. You know, they're a constant pressure environment as well, being freezing.
Well, I mean, if you push hard on liquid water, liquid water is denser than frozen water, so there's a limit to what will happen. I mean, if you put enough pressure on ice, you'll force it to become a liquid, because that's the densest state of water.
But these organisms also are living at that pressure as well. It's a high pressure.
Your organisms at the bottom is a 5-mile trench, right, in the ocean.
Yeah.
So the pressure, they survive at high pressures, is what you're asking.
Yeah, they can survive under those kinds of pressures. In fact, there's a special term for extremophiles that exists under high pressures. But these are creatures that are extremophiles in three ways. They've got the pressure to deal with, there's the temperature to deal with, and it's the fact that they have a very limited chemical source for their energy. So, okay, there is...
Is the freezing point lower because of all the pressure? 32?
It's 32 degrees Fahrenheit.
So?
Yeah.
So. Well, basically, water is compressible, relatively.
Yeah, water's not compressible, so it's right up there at 32 degrees. And what they notice is that the ice layers get thinner and thinner and thinner as you go down, so it tells you there really is a pressure issue that's bound to make liquid water, which is why, for example, ice cores are limited into how much Earth history they can portray. Once you get above about 800,000 layers of ice, the pressure is so extreme that it makes it slushy, and eventually it makes it liquid. Incidentally, there's an ongoing study where they hope to recover the climate history of the Earth for the last 1 million years. But yeah, once you get past 1 million years, it's liquid water. And in terms of a reliable record, we have a reliable record only for the last 800,000 years. But hey, I know people who think that within 2 years they're going to have a reliable record for the last 1 million years. But it's hard work because of how thin the ice layers are and how easily they can melt. So... Okay. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, you mentioned that it stays steady at 32 degrees, and otherwise it would perish, but there are some extremophiles that actually freeze, and then they thaw out. I mean, there are fish that freeze, and then there's this frog in the Arctic, totally freezes into a chunk of ice, and spring comes, it defrosts, and it just pops around and does
wow.
things. So, I mean, it is possible, even if that wasn't so stable, that they could freeze and defrost.
Yeah, there's actually bacteria that can survive at 15 degrees below freezing. And how they do it is these bacteria manufacture antifreeze. So, and the antifreeze chemicals they make are quite sophisticated. But because of that, they also have extremely low metabolic rates. So they're basically hanging on. But again, I want to remind you of Psalm 104. God creates life to live everywhere on the earth and is prepared to design this life in such a way that it can, quote, hang on even in the most extreme conditions. Yeah, over here.
Yeah, can you explain the Russians discovered life in the station on the window and stuff, the space station, and then the Americans confirmed it?
Yeah, that showed up on my Facebook page this morning. You know, can you please explain the microbes they're finding on the International Space Station?
On the outside.
On the outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the inside, they expect to find bacteria, etc. I think I told you once that for every cell in your body, there's 10 bacteria on and in your body. So just think about that when you have your lunch today. Be careful about washing your hands. I mean, there's a fad these days to use antibacterial soap. And the problem with that is it takes all the friendly bacteria off of your hands, and now you're going to get dermatitis. And so that bacteria actually protects your skin. So, be careful not to kill off the friendly bacteria. Okay, and the question was, what about the bacteria they found the outside of the International Space Station? They're still trying to identify exactly what bacteria they found, but they did say they found some bacteria that seem to be living in the ocean that are up there. And it's something that we actually predicted at Reasons to Believe more than 10 years ago, that there's phenomena on the Earth that's going to export viruses and bacteria into outer space. And you know, with the ocean, you've got a wind wave interaction that causes viruses and bacteria to lift out of the sea and into the atmosphere. And if the bacteria and the viruses are small enough, they can get wafted up into outer space. Not a lot, but you're going to get some. And so the fact that these are attached to the International Space Station really is no surprise. Now, what hasn't been done is to measure the actual quantity of these bacteria and viruses and what kind of species we're seeing. So there's still a lot of discussion as to exactly what's there on that space station. And in order to determine what is the source of these bacteria, we're going to need to know that information. Because another pathway for those bacteria to get there is meteoritic impact. You know, when a meteor strikes the Earth and it hits the Earth hard enough, that's going to cause Earth soil or ocean water to be exported from the surface of the Earth into interplanetary space. And just to give you a number, for every ton of Earth soil that's exported into outer space, that ton will contain 100 quadrillion bacteria. So there again, I mean, if you're pumping 100 quadrillion bacteria into outer space with every ton, how much should you expect to find the outer edge of the International Space Station? But the paper was published on this basically says there are pathways by which we know these Earth bacteria could get to the outside of the International Space Station. A third one, of course, would be contamination. Maybe the people who put up the International Space Station weren't careful enough to guarantee. And by the way, NASA does the best every time they send a spaceship. I mean, you people who work at JPL know this. You work really hard to make sure what you send to Mars is sterile. However, JPL and NASA can never guarantee it's perfectly sterile. So there's always a possibility that we've infected Mars with bacteria.
We put on the ship. We don't try to sterilize the space station. It's orbiting Earth. It's only for the planetary probe.
Yeah, I mean, why bother to sterilize a space station because we know it's just in an Earth orbit? And we already know we've got Earth organisms up in that part of outer space, you know, 200-300 miles up.
Yeah, and there's a third possibility, obviously, that's been brought up. Obviously, the space station is pressurized, which means it also can be leaking fluids and food for these things to live on.
Right.
It's pressurized. And anybody that knows anything about, you know, anything, it doesn't stay inflated forever. You always get leaks.
You always get leaks. Yeah.
So it could have been from being fed from the space station.
Right. Which is why the paper concluded and say until we got more extensive measurements on what exactly these bacteria and viruses are, what the quantities are, we're not going to be able to tell you how they got there. But the idea that they can't get there and they must be indigenous, we know that's not the case at all. There's no way anyone is actually suggesting these are anything other than Earth organisms.
How
yes.
Were these organisms discovered by accident, or did they?
No, they purposely looked for them.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, they sent somebody outside the space station and tried to find the organisms, and they were there.
It looks like a green crystal powderizes blood.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as we know, it's not Ebola. So the people on board the spaceship should be okay. Yeah, Steve.
I was introduced on the internet to the strangest creature last night I never knew could exist. It's called a water bear. And if you've heard of it, I think its name is Tachybara or something like that. It can live down to 1 degree above absolute zero.
Yes.
Only 5% live, but if you get 5 degrees above, you get a really good percentage. It can live to 6,000 atmospheres, which is six times the deepest 5-mile trench on Earth at that pressure. It can live up to 300 degrees Fahrenheit, if I believe it is. And it can desiccate to 1% of its total body moisture because it has a protective sugar that will allow it to rehydrate. It essentially can do that and then produce eggs and go on living. And so that's an extremophile.
Yes.
You need to be careful of that, though, because they would and they put it out into space and left it out hanging in space for 10 days and UV and whatever, and it did just fine, came back. And some of them were a little bit crazy, but others did okay. But the trick there is that that even though it's a very interesting animal, and I say animal because it's, the largest ones are half a millimeter size. This is not a small bacterium. It has eight legs, and it looks like a little eight-legged bear. So, but they would like to propose that that would be panspermia, since it lasts so well. Well, you know, I can't say no, but I can say that would be, it would be nice to test it in for 20 years.
Yeah, there's a lot of experiments that have been done in that particular bacterium, because you're right, it's the hardiest bacterium we know of. But the idea that it's a solution to panspermia, this is a bacterium that is basically hanging on for dear life.
It's called more of an animal. There are particular types of animals that all of these animals, they're about, I forget the number of species, 120 or more, happen to have all the same number of cells.
Yeah,
so they're multicellular, and they're just half a millimeter.
Yep.
Maybe related to what he just said. Playing devil's advocate. The bacteria on the space station. Let's say it didn't originate from inside. Excuse me, for the moment. What kind of argument could the transfermia people make? See? Bacteria surviving outer space, so it can survive from another star.
Well, you know, it's exciting. Even the web articles that have been posted on this discovery aren't saying that. Nobody is saying that this is stuff from another planet. They're all recognizing, yeah, this is clearly just life that came from the Earth.
Well, hypothetically, though, let's say if there were bacteria life on another planet, another star system, could they make the argument from this?
Well, for example, what Steve is talking about, you know, these extremophiles, what they call hyper-extremophiles, you know, they can actually survive in a totally desiccated state, and they can survive under very harsh radiation, and people said maybe they could make it across interplanetary space. Okay. The problem is a trip across interplanetary space is going to take millions of years. And during those millions of years, you're not just going to be exposed to the kind of hard radiation that we see in the solar system. You're going to be exposed to even much harder radiation. So no one is claiming that these species could in any way satisfy the requirements for panspermia. Moreover, if they make it to Earth, they're not going to evolve into anything. I mean, they basically are non-evolvers. So and if you look at these things, an incredible amount of their DNA just goes to repair damage that happens over and over again. And so the idea that this is, quote, a simple life form, it's not a simple life form. It's a very complex life form, but almost all of its energy is devoted to repairing the damage that happens. And that's kind of typical of all extremophiles, is that they're basically transferring energy that are, you know, we mesophiles use to do all kinds of fun things like go to this class. They're using all their energy basically to repair damage that occurs. And there's a very interesting paper you can get published in Astrobiology a few years ago. And the title of the paper was Extremophiles Are Irrelevant to the Origin of Life. Is that there's no way you can originate these extremophiles in the absence of mesophiles. And so in that sense, they don't solve the origin of life problem at all. And the idea that they could evolve into more complex life forms, that's not in the cards either.
That was the journal Astrobiology?
Yeah, the journal Astrobiology. I think we actually have a web article on our website called Extremophiles Are Irrelevant to the Origin of Life, and you can get the citation. Yes, John.
Use the term interplanetary. Do you mean interstellar?
Interstellar, sorry. I meant interstellar. I mean like from one planetary system to another planetary system. Yeah, I've been on record since 1988 in saying we will find the remains of life on every solar system body if we look hard enough for it, mainly because of what we've been discussing here. If Earth life can make it up to the International Space Station, it can also make it to Mars and the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. And so, you know, there's some friends of mine who have calculated that on the surface of the moon, there's 20,000 kilograms of Earth soil for every 100 square kilometers. And so actually the moon is the only place that we can go realistically where we can find the fossils of Earth's first life. They'll never be found in the Earth because the Earth's geology has destroyed them, but they're there in pristine form on the moon. I say that because my friends have also calculated the velocities with which this Earth soil made it to the surface of the moon 3.8 billion years ago, and show that it arrived on the surface of the moon with low velocity collision events, which means they should be present to this day on the surface of the moon undisturbed. So we should actually find pristine fossils of Earth's first life on the moon.
Yeah, freeze-dried would be correct.
Correct. So
freeze-dried bacteria there.
Right. And as to why the Apollo astronauts didn't find that stuff, keep in mind Apollo was given the mission to recover pristine lunar rocks. They were not interested in finding the Earth transported soil. But I'll tell you this, the Chinese are interested in finding that. So they may be the ones that actually recover the fossils of Earth's first life. Yes.
As far as the origin of life, these guys, the University of Washington, I forget their names, they give a lot of credence to the origin of life for the extremophiles, I believe.
Yeah, you're talking Peter Ward.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, Peter Ward and I debated the origin of life at a university in the state of Washington. And that was a big part of our debate. Are these extremophiles actually a candidate for the origin of life and where we all came from? So, and he was arguing the affirmative that they were. I was saying, no, that they're not. It's not realistic that this could happen. So, and you know, that was a major topic at one of the Origin of Life conferences that Fuzz and I attended. And their whole point is, as challenging as it is for us materialists to explain the origin of life or the life that we're trying to explain are mesophilic, it's orders of magnitude more challenging to explain the origin of life under these extreme conditions. And that was the basis for the paper. Extremophiles are irrelevant to the origin of life. And mainly what you're dealing with is under these extreme conditions, the half-lives of the building block molecules that are necessary to construct this life are orders of magnitude shorter than they are under, you know, benign temperature conditions. Likewise, with the pressure, the acidity, you know, if you're talking about life that exists under basic conditions or acidic conditions, again, it dramatically shortens the half-life. And again, that was a good part of the debate that we had up there in the state of Washington.
Do you have a question from our first visitor?
Yeah.
We keep saying that the extremophiles sometimes are non-evolving, but I don't understand that because if I understand it correctly, evolution is an entirely passive process. It's in the mutations are entirely random.
Yes.
And then what would cause mutations not to happen?
It's not that they don't happen, is that these extremophiles have extremely low metabolic rates, which means they're reproducing at a very low level. And so the idea that you're going to get significant evolution requires large populations and requires you have a high reproductive rate. And that's what's missing for these extremophiles. The reproductive rate is extremely low, and their population levels are way down. So that being the case, yeah, I'm not saying they don't evolve at all. The other thing is the slightest bit of evolution that takes place in these creatures usually is fatal. They haven't got a lot of room to have their DNA changed. As I said, you know, most of the energy that these extremophiles harvest goes to repairing damage. But if the damage is too extreme, they wind up being killed. So yeah, I mean, if you want something, I mean, for example, your most efficient evolver are bacteria that exist under benign conditions because they have a high reproductive rate. They can multiply up into the quadrillions, which gives you a much higher probability, and they can exchange genes.
But then, let's say you have extremophiles in a highly acidic lake. What happens when wind blows them onto the surface and then one or two of them evolve into slightly less, higher metabolism because now they're in less of a part, they're not as stress. So they can, they get a little bit more breathing room, they evolve a teeny tiny bit. Now they can evolve more, and then more, and then more, exponentially until they...
Yeah, here's the problem. If you move an extremophile from an extreme environment into a benign environment, they die immediately. And they can only survive in that particular extreme environment. So moving them into so they're highly specialized. They can only survive, say, under extremely acidic conditions or under extremely freezing conditions. So you can't take an extremophile from, say, an acidic base and put them in a basic base. They won't survive.
The other part we have to go, obviously, is we have to talk about other mutations. Is you're giving mutations a lot more credit than what it is. The evidence has proved that mutations for almost all species drive them to extinction, with the exception of bacteria, virus, and maybe termites, and maybe ants. And so the mutations just don't produce anything. And so mutations typically will drive things extinct, is what he was saying. So you can't even assume that, obviously, that this bacteria was to make it to a good environment that it could evolve more. There's no mechanism for doing that.
Yeah, typically the reason why bacteria are efficient evolvers is not because of mutations, but because of gene exchange. But again, if you look at extremophiles, they don't have the capability of exchanging genes that you see with mesophiles. So, yeah.
And you're frequently called the outcome of an Origin of Life conference in Cancun. I think it was 15 or 20 years ago, presided by Stephen Jay Gould, the Harvard paleontologist that was so strongly, promoting the idea of evolution. And after all the research was presented at that conference, I understand, he, in a summary, commented, he said, well, looks like all the evidence is against us. Basically, the research at that time that he's thinking that even got worse indicated it was just utterly inconceivable that life could ever have originated from natural processes. So Stephen Gould said, we know that evolution must be true, so it must be that once upon a time, in a star system far, far away, a civilization determined to put a similar capsule and directed life forms to target the Earth. In other words, that, from the evidence, that was the only conclusion we could come to that could support the evolutionary theory, and it's what I now come to call fairy tale science. He didn't phrase it exactly the way I did, but he embodied that concept, and he introduced the notion of directed panspermia, that there was some intelligent direction.
Well, John, that has happened at virtually every Origin of Life research conference. I mean, the ones that Fuzz and I attended, I remember back in 2002, where they said, you know, we've had this 5-day conference. The first day we ruled out planet Earth as a site for the origin of life. And it's because we have evidence that Earth never had prebiotics and life arose almost instantaneously on a geological time scale. And they said, well, if you don't even have the building blocks, obviously it can't arise here. So the second day of the conference, they said it must have arisen on Mars and then got transported from Mars to the Earth. But then they ruled out Mars. Mars has got the same problems that the Earth has, only worse. So they said, well, let's go to the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. And that got ruled out on the third day. And they said, well, maybe we got a rock from another planetary system. But I remember this one Australian physicist got up and showed a calculation where they said, you know, let's just assume that every star in our Milky Way galaxy has a planet orbiting it where life is just as abundant as it is on planet Earth and is being bombarded aggressively by meteors and asteroids and therefore exporting its life into outer space. And because on the fourth day of the conference, they said, we know it can't be dust carrying a bacterium because that dust is going to get exposed to radiation and it's going to break down the life form. And there was one scientist who said, the only way life could get from a planetary system to our planetary system is if it's inside a big rock. And he calculated the rock had to be a minimum of 2 meters in diameter with no porosity and no cracks, with a bacterium in the dead center. They said that would survive the harsh radiation of the outer space travel and make it all the way to planet Earth. But this Australian physicist did a calculation where he showed how many rocks, you know, given that all planets in the Milky Way, every star had a planet just like Earth and was being bombarded aggressively by asteroids, how many rocks would be delivered to planet Earth. And he calculated that we would only get one rock the size of a human fist being deposited on the surface of the Earth from another planetary system once every 10 to the 16 years. Well, that's a million times older than the universe. So, and that's just a rock the size of a human fist. Another physicist got up and said, there's no way you're going to have even a 2-meter diameter rock that's got no porosity and no cracks in it. So he said, you're really going to need an even bigger rock. And that's when finally a gentleman came up to the microphone and said, in this conference, we've ruled out the Earth, we've ruled out Mars, we've ruled out all the bodies in the solar system, we've ruled out panspermia, and we've ruled out a rock bringing life from another planetary system of planet Earth. That means there's only one conclusion left. There must have been an intelligent civilization on a distant planet that built a spaceship, came to planet Earth, and put life here 3.8 billion years ago. And by the way, they must have come back for the Avalon explosion, the Cameron explosion. They must have come back for the first birds. And, you know, people didn't laugh. They just said, yeah, really? I mean, that's... And there's a gentleman in front of us. You know, Fuzz and I were sitting in front of a fellow who's Robert Shapiro, also known as Dr. No. And we've interviewed him. You can listen to his interview. He describes himself as atheist/agnostic. But, you know, he said, we got to be honest about this. Our materialistic models aren't working. And, you know, here we have this amazing chemistry that shows how you can take amino acids and join them together. But what we notice is that, you know, the more we join together, the harder it is to pull that polymer off the substrate. In fact, once you get past that joining together 40 amino acids, you can't pull it off the substrate at all. It's stuck. And he says, you know, amazing chemistry, but this is irrelevant to the origin of life on planet Earth 3.8 billion years ago. This isn't helping at all. It says, if you keep up with these conferences, we're going to be talking intelligent design. And everybody was horrified when he said that. So, but that's the comment he made after this gentleman got up to the microphone and said panspermia. He says, does he realize what he's saying? The idea that there could be intelligent life existing in our galaxy 3.8 billion years ago? You know, we've already had papers at this conference showing that the earliest time you can possibly conceive of having the simplest bacterium is 3.8 billion years ago. You know, it's interesting. Earth had the very first life that's even conceivably possible given the physics of our universe. And so there's no way you're going to go from a bacterium to human beings or the equivalent in a few months. It's going to take billions of years. So he says there's no way they could have brought here. And you know, then we talked to him and said, well, we got another issue here. And it's something you'll see in our book. I think we have it there on the table. Yeah, I see it there. Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. It's a book we wrote on extraterrestrial life, making the point that even if God were to create this life on another planetary system, the physics of our galaxy simply would not permit them to have life within a spaceship going from their planetary system to our planetary system. The point is, there's a limit to how fast you can go. Now, a lot of you have been watching Star Trek and where they go warp 9 or whatever. What we show in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, you're basically limited to going 0.01 warp. If you go faster than that, you'll destroy your ship and the life on board because you're going to bump into stuff. So you've got to watch how fast you go. And by the way, you can't go in a straight line to your planetary system. You're going to have to dodge the dangerous stuff as you go. And so given the velocity limit and the pathway you've got to take, you're looking at in excess of 25,000 years just to go from, say, a planetary system that's 200 light years away and making it here to planet Earth. And, you know, and here's a problem. At that same conference, a pig guy published a paper making the point, okay, if we look at technology, what does technology do to an intelligent civilization? It drives them to extinction. It drives them to extinction in less than 2,000 years. So you need to think about that. And by the way, what they were talking about is a level of technology that we manifested in 1945. So that level of technology or greater will guarantee that if that technology is sustained, the species is extinct in less than 2,000 years. And if you can read the book. We explain why it must go extinct that fast. So technology is not necessarily a good thing. Oh, and by the way, if you're concerned about your great-great-great-great-great, etc. children that are going to be living 3,000 years from now, there is a way out. Human beings could live a lot longer here on planet Earth if we get rid of our wealth and get rid of our technology and go back to the Stone Age and go back to just a few million people. You know, that was a reaction of my sons. I said, we'd rather our grandchildren go extinct than give up our technology.
In the middle of the last century, science fiction writers were remarkably accurate about predicting what kind of technologies we'd have for going to the moon and satellite communications, etc. How has their record been in the last 30 years or so? Obviously they've predicted warp drives and that kind of stuff, but you're saying that's not possible. Is most of what they're dreaming about now just physically impossible, unlike, say, 50 years ago?
Well, you can get a book written by our nation's most famous atheist, Lawrence Krauss. He wrote a book called The Physics of Star Trek. And basically in The Physics of Star Trek, he explains why this is not like Jules Verne, where Jules Verne was saying, this is what technology is going to be like 100 years from now. And, you know, Jules Verne was virtually right on everything that he predicted, because he wasn't going beyond the limits of the laws of physics. What Lawrence Krauss points out, if you watch Star Trek, they're violating the laws of physics everywhere. So he's got a chapter on why what's this thing they call where your molecules are destroyed and reconstructed? Yeah. Teleportation. He explains why that's impossible. Huh?
They predicted these.
Yes. Yeah, they did. They were right on that one.
And medical trends thingies, you know.
Well, I mean, that's something that Lawrence Krauss points out. The physics of Star Trek, what is actually possible within the laws of physics and what is not. And so he points out that warp 9 won't work, warp 1 won't work, and teleportation won't work, and lots of other things. You have those crystal things.
Somebody can find some of those things. They make a lot of money.
Yeah, you could make some really good batteries if you can find them.
What science fiction writer predicted internet radio, internet TV?
That was Al Gore, I thought. In the back.
Who was it that predicted?
It might be an obvious question, but talking about mesophiles and the extreme
files. Is it obvious that you're talking that they can evolve into a mesophile? They're two different creations. Well, if you want to go a little further on this, there's a number of experiments being done called long-term evolution experiments, where they're actually testing how efficiently different species can evolve. And these are idealized experiments where they're basically doing laboratory controls to force evolution to happen as aggressively as the laws of physics and chemistry will permit. So they're recognizing this is not realistic in terms of what can happen. Although I will say this, there's a group of Mexican researchers that are doing experiments in a particular dry lake area of Mexico where they're trying to do a long-term evolution experiment where they don't invoke laboratory tampering. But the advantage of the laboratory tampering is you get to see where the hard limits of evolution are. And what's interesting is that they're doing multiple experiments where they can test what's possible for certain bacteria against other bacteria, against viruses, against yeast, and they're actually discovering which species are really the most efficient evolvers. And the most efficient they found so far is E. coli bacteria. Probably not a surprise, right? Because we get E. coli outbreaks of different issues. And so they're actually using that to test different models on, because, you know, within the Darwinian spectrum, there are competing models of how all this works. And so probably the most famous one is the one done at Michigan State University. It's still running. It's been going for 25 years now. But the goal is to keep it running. And they were trying to test Gould's theory for Darwinian evolution against Simon Conway Morris's theory for evolution. And basically they proved that Gould's theory was right and Simon Conway Morris's theory was not correct. But it didn't solve the problem of how you get this from a materialistic paradigm. And if you're not familiar, Gould's theory was that if you were to rewind the evolutionary clock and let evolution go again, you would never get the identical outcome. You would always get a different random outcome. So his point is these evolutionary mechanisms are truly random in what they produce. Simon Conway Morris's point was, well, if we look at biology, we see repeated outcomes everywhere. Literally thousands of examples where we get different species of life in totally different environments, even totally different phyla, producing the identical outcomes. So he says there must be some hidden law of physics that actually makes these things happen. Well, these long-term evolution experiments have showed it isn't a hidden law of physics. We kind of knew that already because the laws of physics are quite well investigated. But now it's a conundrum. Okay, we proved that Gould was right about how evolution works, but what do we do with all these repeated outcomes? So Simon Conway Morris says there's still something missing, which is why we've developed the model. The missing factor is God bringing in the repeated optimal designs. Because what we see in these cases where you have repeated outcomes, the repeated outcome is always an optimal design. And so what's an optimal design, say, for a chameleon, a desert reptile, would also be optimal for a fish that lives at the bottom of shallow marine environments. And so it's not surprising from a creation perspective that you've got these identical outcomes. But the experiments are still running and basically addresses your question about extremophiles. In the sense that what we're saying is you need a mesophile to really get evolution moving in a very efficient way. But you've got another follow-up. Oh, and we're out of time.
No,
okay.
We can see the visitor. We're going to take him as the last
okay.
one. And then we'll just, I'm sorry, you'll have to ask.
First, warp drives are theoretically possible. Transporters are theoretically possible. The ships run off antimatter, not dilithium.
Yeah, you get the most hate mail over the subject, and you can guess why.
Well,
I love the Stamets quote. I've used that one, obviously. It's a difficult for me, as I'm an engineer, obviously, to watch a show that violates the law of physics about every 5 minutes, you know. I mean, I've had boys your age come up to me and ask me, you know, what is more deadlier, you know, a lightsaber or a gaff ray, you know, gun, you know. I'm obviously, because I don't want to destroy, you know, his enjoyment of science. Because I love science fiction, but I know what the FI and sci-fi stands for.
Well, you can listen to an interview. We interviewed Jerry Cleaver. He was a friend of mine when he was at Caltech. He's now the chairman of the physics department at Baylor University. And he got a bunch of graduate students together, and they said, okay, let's actually look at this warp drive thing. And they actually found a way that you could move a spaceship at greater than the velocity of light. And what they were doing was finding a way that they could distort the space-time fabric of the universe. And by distorting the space-time fabric of the universe, you can mathematically move an object at greater than the velocity of light. But then they calculated how much energy they would need to be able to distort the space-time fabric to be able to go faster than the velocity of light. So we're talking a 1 gram mass. Moving a 1 gram mass at, say, 1 or 2% faster than the velocity of light, they said they would have to convert the planet Jupiter, all of its mass, into pure energy and do that every microsecond in order to be able to move this gram greater than the velocity of light, and only a little bit greater than the velocity of light. And their whole point was, yes, it's mathematically possible, but physically impossible. So there's nothing in the laws of physics that would, quote, forbid it, if you're prepared to be able to distort the space-time fabric sufficiently to make it work. But look at all the energy you need to be able to pull it off.
Yeah, I want to say, obviously, that mankind has done two long-term experiments on evolution, and obviously not enough people write about it. My first opinion is if you study horses and dogs, that humans have been breeding them for over 5,000, 10,000, maybe 15,000 years, and I conclude that that is a long-term evolutionary study where we were purposely trying to make these horses either bigger or smaller, dogs smaller or bigger, you know, a particular characteristic. And so we've seen what the limit of evolution does, and every time that man has tried to force a species away from its norm, that species has a short lifespan, becomes more sick, you know, more mutations, like our, you know, Dalmatian dogs that can't hear, you know, or the Great Danes, or, you know, big dogs that just don't live very long. And so we've done these long-term experiments on horses and dogs, and it's shown, obviously, that life likes to stay the same, but it doesn't like to change.
Period. Yeah, and most mammals are like that. They don't tolerate change. The one thing about dogs is, of all the mammal species we know of, they have the greatest possibility for this microevolutionary change.
Because they were designed for it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about dogs. You can design them to do virtually any kind of thing that you want them to do in terms of relating to you. And the latest development is they've actually bred dogs to be clothing tolerant, because now we've got women that like to dress their dogs up. So they've actually bred dogs that can do that. But, I mean, to take your example, we've actually pushed dog breeding to such an extreme that we've got what we call teacup poodles. They're poodles that fit inside a teacup. But if you actually hold one, they're vibrating all the time. And there's only so many months they can vibrate before they die. So, and if you were to release those vibrating teacup poodles into the wild, how long are they going to survive? Well, we're probably looking at hours maximum. And likewise is what happens when you look at the dogs that we bred to very large sizes. If they were released in the wild, they wouldn't make it for very long either. So yeah, you're right. That's an experiment we've been done.
If my evolutionist friends tell me that a whale came from a wolf, I'd say the whale should have a life expectancy about 2 months then. You know, because if you make an animal larger, its lifespan's going to go down. And yet,
sure.
Whales that live obviously a long time. Close with some prayer.
Hey, I'll close you in prayer.
Thank the Lord for packing our planet full of this wonderful life.
Yes. If you want to see some examples of these discoveries, you can go to, let me see if I got it up here. Here we go. Oh, what happened? Yeah. We have, and by the way, every one of our scholars has a Twitter account where we try to keep you up to date in some of these latest scientific discoveries. And then we've got a little more room to do that in our Facebook, so feel free to visit those. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the privilege of being alive in the 21st century, a time when we get to see the handiwork of you in remarkable ways across all the disciplines that make up your book, the Book of Nature. And Father, we thank you for the book of Scripture that is loaded with literally dozens of texts that deal with creation and the history of life on planet Earth. And Father, I pray you continue to bless us as we go through these texts, and as we integrate them with all the disciplines that make up your book of nature. And Father, I pray that we would use these new evidences for your handiwork as a means by which we can introduce people to the love, the truth, and the life that you make available to us through the Creator of everything, namely Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name, amen.